It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Mean Joe Green, Terry Bradshaw, and Franco Harris played major roles in the 1970s Steelers dynasty. On assignment for the Washington Post in 1981, Gary Pomerantz interviewed them to see if the dynasty at that time was in decline. Years later, Mr. Pomerantz interviewed these players and others to see how football had formed their bonds of friendship both on and off the field. What he discovered is chronicled in his new book, Their Life's Work, The Brotherhood of the 1970s Pittsburgh Steelers Then and Now. Tomorrow night, the Western Pennsylvania Sports Museum at the Heinz History Center will host a national launch of the book, which features more than 200 interviews with former Steelers players, coaches, and their families. As part of the launch, Steelers greats Franco Harris, Rocky Blyer, Andy Russell, and Dan Rooney will appear with Mr. Pomerantz, who joins us now in Studio A. Gary Pomerantz, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Great to be back with you.
And you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Again, our number is 412-246-2002. Gary Pomerantz, you had the assignment covering the Pittsburgh Steelers in the 80s, and that brought to you an opportunity to see the Steelers both as immortals back then and now, as you write this book, as you have written this book, as aging and in some cases frail older men. And there's a part of your book where you address this, and would you care to share that passage with us as we begin this interview?
Certainly. At 20, a kid just beginning an adult's life in 1981, I saw the Steelers of Mean Joe Green as armored gods. I cared about the game then, but now, past 50 with a life's experiences, I care about the lives. The Steelers of grandfatherly Joe Green have become a rich and revealing expression of pro football's gifts and costs. The gifts came in their 20s, the costs in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. With the game's violence under scrutiny, the attention now is on brain injury, surely football's highest cost. But many former NFL players in midlife also suffer daily debilitating pain in the hips, shoulders, knees, and backs. These costs are real and lasting. Still, the 1970 Steelers were a force of nature, and even in the twilight of their lives, the memory of their sheer power shines brilliantly.
Tell us about the assignment that you had covering the Steelers in the 80s and how that really was the germination of this book.
So it was 32 years ago.
Hard to believe.
Summer of 1981. I was a mere sports writing intern at the Washington Post, and I got this dream assignment. You know, go to La Trobe, to St. Vincent College, and write a story. Spend a couple days with the Pittsburgh Steelers to see if the league's defining dynasty was finally done. And nearly all the stars were still there. I interviewed Terry Bradshaw, John Stallworth, Lynn Swann, Franco Harris. And I remember sitting with Mean Joe Green. It was a sweltering August day. He's wearing a T-shirt and shorts. And as he's talking, I'm thinking, this man's bicep is wider than my thigh. And even a 20-year-old couldn't miss this arresting array of talent and personality, great characters. And so that's where this seed was first planted, way back when, and more recently, in recent years, with the game of football under the microscope for its violence and brain injuries front center. I began to think, if I were to take on the game for what it gives and what it takes, who better than the greatest team since the Earth's crust cooled, right? The Pittsburgh Steelers of the 70s, those men I met 32 years ago.
And we hear about dynasties in football as well as other sports, but what made the Steelers dynasty, these teams in the 70s that won four Super Bowls in 6 years, special beyond those numbers?
Yeah, well, first, of course, there's great talent. Nine Hall of Fame players in one time is astonishing. But I think what many fans don't recognize is they had a closeness then. And you hear that said all the time. Players today, though, will never experience that kind of closeness because of free agency. They're now free to jump team to team for bigger contracts. But there's an amazing statistic where if you take eight players from that team, Joe Green and L.C. Greenwood, Donnie Shell, Terry Bradshaw, Stallworth and Swan, Jack Lambert, Jack Ham. Eight players played 100 seasons in the NFL, a century's worth, every one of them for the Pittsburgh Steelers. So what did that mean? That mean they knew each other intuitively. They knew the women they loved and the beer they drank. Lambert, by the way, Michelob in bottles, never cans. the cigarettes they smoked. They knew the movements on the field. There was a certain synergy there that's difficult to recapture today because of the player movement.
And because so many of these players came up together, you know, you had and because they went through so many tough years together, in some cases a decade before winning the Super Bowl in Andy Russell and Ray Mansfield's case, and Andy Russell was pretty close to that. They played on some terrible teams back in the old Pitt Stadium days. Mean Joe Green and Terry Hanratty were on a team that went 1-13. Terry Bradshaw was then drafted as a result of the Steelers being at the bottom. They had the first pick. He comes in, and people are calling him because of his accent, saying he's a dumb hick from Louisiana. And then a couple years later, these perennial losers are Super Bowl champions. Did having to go through so much adversity and then winning together, did that make it a more special and deeper experience for these guys together?
It did, and of course for the city as well. Remember, this is the 70s. Steel is dying. And so this team, all of a sudden, everything goes right and all heaven breaks loose in Pittsburgh. And there's just a confluence of players and factors that make this so memorable. You know, it's a bygone period. It's a time when the chief, Art Rooney Sr., the owner, is inviting some of his favorite players, Joe Green, Dwight White, Franco Harris, Terry Bradshaw, and their wives to dinner at home at 940 North Lincoln. The players loved the chief, who was a bumbling loser in football for 40 years. Now, at the horse track, quite different, right? He was one of America's leading horse players.
Well, that's how he bought the team, isn't it?
Well, he paid $2,500 in 1933 for this franchise. He was, you know, betting more than that on individual races. Today, the value of the franchise has been measured or estimated somewhere between $1 billion and $1.2 billion, so it's a pretty good investment. But it all came together at that time, and you know, people here maybe take it for granted a little bit because, you know, so many of these guys are still in town. They see them. But in some ways, it's like standing at the foot of Everest and never looking up. So my task here was to go back in time, to find these guys, and to bring it back to life on the page. I wanted to put the reader there. I wanted to put the reader in the locker room at Three Rivers Stadium. I wanted to put the reader in the defensive huddle of the Steel Curtain defense, even at Ernie Holmes' bachelor party in 1976. Now, there's a night everyone in attendance will never forget.
What happened?
Well, bottles of Crevassier were crashing, all of them because of Ernie Holmes. And most of the stories I heard about Ernie Holmes, who was a member of the Steel Curtain front four, had to do with either barbecued meat, Crevassier, or rage, or a combination of them. And so stories, great stories, poignant stories. And following this team then across time, you know, what I discovered here is when I sat down with these men is how differently we look at our lives in our 20s than our 50s and 60s, right? And maybe everyone knows this, but it was really, a profound difference here. You know, in your 20s, when you're playing in the NFL with these guys, you know, you're invincible, you're bulletproof, and you look at 50 or 60 through a telescope. It's like a faraway planet. It's your father's world. But now when you're in your 60s, as these guys are, a little bit more life experience, wisdom, and you see yourself more in context, and you realize this life is not forever, and you really begin to cherish those friendships. I mean, I can tell you my greatest takeaway from this book is to realize – you know, my special friendships in life, you know, not to take them for granted, to really cherish them, because this time on the planet isn't forever.
How close were these Steelers players?
They were close. And I'm not going to sing, you know, a Disney song here and tell you it's all about family, because I've never been one to believe that these sports franchises, even those that win constantly and create dynasties, are families. Unless accepting the understanding that all families are in some way dysfunctional. But brotherhood, oh yeah, I believe in brotherhood. And I saw it. I saw it in 100 ways. I saw it in an interview I did with Joe Green. We were talking about the passing of Dwight White. And Joe was remembering that moment when he was in Texas and he got the call from Franco Harris here in Pittsburgh when he said about Dwight, you know, he's gone. And I remember Joe just staring off in the distance saying, he's gone. And he was inhabiting that moment once more, and tears were filling his eyes. You know, I saw it in the way Rocky Blyer came up to L.C. Greenwood, who just passed away, at a celebrity golf tournament, and he gave him a big hug from behind. And L.C. turns back and says, prune juice. And I asked L.C. later, prune juice, what does that mean? And L.C. said, well, you know, O.J. Simpson was orange juice, and Rock didn't quite move as fast. You can see it in their eyes. You can see that special feeling they have for each other. I'm not suggesting that they're calling each other and they're, you know, emailing every 15 minutes. But, you know, we all have certain friendships in our lives, be it from high school, college, an old job, when we were in the process of becoming who we became. This experience that these men had for a decade and more was of an intensity that few of us will ever know. And so, too, with that friendship.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Gary Pomerantz, author of Their Life's Work, The Brotherhood of the 1970s Pittsburgh Steelers, Then and Now. How different was life in the NFL for the men who played the game back in 1970 compared, or during the 70s, compared to today's NFL?
Well, as a matter of context, in 1970, the average salary in the NFL, you ready for this? $23,000.
Wow.
By 1980, $80,000. Okay, so it had more than tripled, but still not the, you know, the big numbers with all those zeros that we're so accustomed to today. A number of these guys had jobs in the offseason. Rocky Blyer sold insurance. L.C. Greenwood was a substitute teacher. Andy Russell got into the investment business. They had to do this, right? Because, you know, this football wasn't forever. They also, it was not a full-time, year-round proposition in terms of their physical training. So, you know, the question always comes, you know, how do you think the Steelers would do today? You know, their defensive line, only 265, 270 pounds on average. Today, well over 300.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my answer to that is there are certain kinds of greatness that transcend time. I mean, you think if Fred Astaire was around today, he might be a pretty good dancer. You know, you think if Dr. King were around, he'd be a pretty good public speaker, an orator, right? So too with these guys. I what would happen if they were playing today? Well, they'd be on weights. They'd be on year-round weight training. Lambert would be a little bigger. Green would be bigger. And they had this great gift that I think transcends time.
Today, of course, there is drug testing. And we know that some players years ago were using steroids, and certainly some may still be using them today, or some prohibited substance. How much of the drug use was being monitored back in the 70s? And for that matter, who was looking at concussion symptoms and things like that?
Well, first off, concussions. Back then, it was, you know, they held up a few fingers, said, how many am I holding up? And they held up three. You said two. They say, all right, you're good. Go back in. You know, maybe they'd give you some smelling salts.
So rarely would a player be pulled out of the game who was suffering concussion-like symptoms, if they were even diagnosed.
It's like a twisted ankle. You know, I mean, it was just a football injury. It was not seen as something with long-lasting consequences, right? So, you know, a lot of that has changed. You know, steroids. Now, steroid testing, the steroids were not illegal in the 70s. It was suggested that maybe you shouldn't use them. It wasn't until the 80s when the NFL started to crack down on them. And reputationally, the Steelers of the 70s are considered a team that had some steroid users. In fact, one of their own, Steve Corson, in 1991, in a book he wrote, Corson, an offensive lineman, talked about his own steroid use and said that three-quarters of the offensive linemen had experimented with them. And I can tell you in my conversation with the players, they would tell you that, yeah, they are pretty sure that some of those players were using. And so too with the rest of the league. I think the Steelers are often picked on here for this reputationally because, one, they were winning, and two, there were a number of players who were participating in that old NFL Strongest Man contest in the early 80s. It was a made-for-TV event. They were all muscled up.
But it wasn't like the other teams weren't doing this as well.
Yeah. Now, I can't sit here, Paul, and tell you that, you know, 28% of this team was using and 72% of that. You know, it's a hush-hush thing. But now all these decades later, you start to hear a little bit more about, yeah, we were using, but not that much. And it's very difficult to pin down.
And you caught up with several of these players, the Steelers, years later. And today, some of them are really struggling mentally and physically. Describe some of what you saw.
Well, I should say that many of them are doing great. Many of them are thriving, you know, perhaps right at the top. Terry Bradshaw as a celebrity in Hollywood, a sportscaster. John Stallworth has been a very impressive success in business. Went down to Alabama and started a information technology company in the aerospace industry and sold it for almost $70 million. Others are struggling physically. You know, Franco Harris would tell you that he's taking blueberries and fish oil every morning for breakfast because he assumes that he has suffered some level of brain damage, and so has every other player who ever played this game. And he's hoping to delay some of the cognitive decline that that some studies show can be delayed through taking blueberries and fish oil.
But some of the guys are already experiencing this.
Yeah, Donnie Schell would tell you that he's having some memory problems. Donnie Schell was a hard-hitting safety. I said, what do you attribute that to, Donnie? And he said, I'm quite sure it's football. Terry Bradshaw in 2011 very publicly announced that he had gone to a clinic for brain scans in Southern California. And he started taking mood boost pills and energy boost pills. And he was also suffering some hand-eye coordination deficit. So he bought two ping pong tables. And he was instructed to download brain puzzles on the internet. Terry was saying that he would memorize stats and names the night before going on air, and then he would forget them. So something wasn't right. And he suffered 7 or 8 concussions at that time. So he's quite sure, too, it's football.
The spoils of victory are Vince Lombardi trophies and Super Bowl rings. And then if you won individual honors, there are plaques and trophies that go along with those. It was interesting to read about John Stallworth and how apparently he doesn't keep any of that in his office.
What John Stallworth realized was when Chuck Knoll said to his players, it will be time to get on with your life's work. You know, some took it as a death knell to their careers as Steelers. You know, it was like acid poured over their dreams. Others took it more constructively as a call to action. They understood that what Knoll was saying is, in this game of football, you're only one play away from retirement. Injuries happen, and sometimes they're pretty severe injuries. And so, John Stallworth is a perfect example of someone who went back and got his master's degree while still playing for the Steelers. And so some, you know, took that upon themselves and went to work with it. Others didn't. The stories just, pour forth when you sit with these guys, and you can see them become young again. And one of the great moments for me was sitting with Joe Green in his living room in Texas. I brought a DVD of Super Bowl IX and also the AFC title game. Well, there's one moment where we're watching the game against the Raiders, 1974 AFC title game. And I said to Joe, I said, it wasn't caught on camera, but this is the game where you kicked the center, Jim Otto, between his legs and dropped him in a rage. And Joe's wonderful wife, Agnes, said, oh, Joe wouldn't do that, not to Jim. And Joe just kept staring at the TV screen, wasn't saying a word. And then we're watching this DVD of Super Bowl IX, and in the third quarter, the Steelers assert control and start to move ahead. And there's Joe on his couch chanting, here we go, Steelers, here we go. And he was a kid. He was young again. And frankly, it was beautiful to see.
We're talking with Gary Pomerantz. He is the author of Their Life's Work, The Brotherhood of the 1970s Pittsburgh Steelers, Then and Now. We have a few minutes left with him if you'd like to join the conversation or if a question has come to mind as you listen to Gary talk about some of the things that he was witness to as he put this book together. You can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. I was struck by the story of Reggie Harrison, who now goes by the name Kamal Ali Salam El, and how he is so physically damaged now that he has a hard time getting out of his chair. But takes comfort in being able to wear his Super Bowl rings. How many of these guys do you think, Gary, if they had it to do all over again, would trade their experiences as Steelers to have healthier minds and bodies today?
I interviewed 24 of them from those years between 74 and 80, and the answer is none. Every last one of them said they'd do it again, and it was worth it. And, you know, Randy Grossman, the tight end on that team, put it like this. He said, you know, we all had our physical gifts. He said, that's what separated us from the faceless crowd. It made us special, and it gave us a sense of self-worth, and that alone is special. And two, Paul, I would say we all make compromises in our lives, all of us. You know, the 60-hour-a-week businessman doesn't see his kids that often. And the minister and the social worker follow their calling and give up money in so doing. These guys knew that this is what set them apart. And so that means that they walked into the arena, into the brilliant light on a Sunday and heard the roar of the crowd. And now they pay the physical consequences. They pay the cost. And to a man, they live with it.
My guest has been Gary Pomerantz, author of their life's work, The Brotherhood of the 1970s Pittsburgh Steelers, Then and Now. Tomorrow night, the Western Pennsylvania Sports Museum at the Heinz History Center will host a national launch of the book. Former Steelers players, coaches, and their families will be part of it, including Steelers greats Franco Harris, Rocky Blyer, Andy Russell, and Dan Rooney, who will appear with Mr. Pomerantz. Gary Pomerantz, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh, and good luck with the book.
Thanks so much. Always a pleasure to be on with you.
Coming up, contributor Rebecca Harris looks at increasing business at the Pittsburgh International Airport. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.